Well, good evening and welcome to the fifth presentation and this our 15th season of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster just back from China taking pictures, Haiwan Wan, and our facility specialist, Daniel Peach. Katie Reuter and Chris DeMeo designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadon Melke. Our speaker tonight is a seventh generation Mississippian who was born in Meridian and grew up in Carrollton. Most branches of his family lived through the ordeal of the Civil War, and five of his direct ancestors fought to defend Vicksburg. He received his BA and MA at the University of Mississippi and a PhD in history at Mississippi State University. He served as park ranger at the Shiloh National Park for 6 years and now teaches history at the University of Tennessee at Martin, where he was the online teacher of the year in 2009-2010. He's the author of 12 books published by the University Presses of Tennessee, Mississippi, Kansas, and Southern Illinois, and has won numerous awards. He's written about the battles and battlefields of Shiloh, Chickamauga, the Siege of Vicksburg, and a major new reinterpretation on life on the home front in Mississippi during the Civil War. His books have been selections of the History Book Club, the Military Book Club, and the Book of the Month Club. And his Shiloh, Conqueror Parish, which we have a couple copies here today, published by the University of Kansas Press, won the Tennessee History Book Award and has been called the new standard treatment of the Shiloh Battle. Said a reviewer for the Civil War Times, only the dead know Shiloh better than Tim Smith. In his newest book, altogether fitting and proper, Civil War Battlefield Preservation, History, Memory, and Policy, 1861 to 2015, published by the University of Tennessee Press in 2017, he discusses federal, state, local, and private efforts to preserve Civil War battlefields. He's presently researching a new book on Vicksburg. Please welcome Tim Smith. Tim?
Well, thank you very much. What an introduction. Did my mama write that for you? That was great. It is a pleasure to be here with you tonight. I've been looking forward to this, and I have several different areas of interest. Largest, I guess, being Civil War, military aspects, but I'm also interested, very interested, in battlefield preservation, and some of you are as well. I've seen by the hats back there, the Association of the Preservation of Civil War Sites. That goes back a while, and so if you've been to how many of you have been to a Civil War battlefield, Fort Donelson or Shiloh or some of those, most everybody has. You know, we step on a Civil War battlefield and we think, well, this has always been there, you know, but there was a lot of effort that went into producing what you see now as a preserved Civil War battlefield. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the story of Civil War battlefield preservation tonight, and I'm not going to do that by using PowerPoint. You can see this is my PowerPoint presentation. It is not even PowerPoint. To be perfectly honest, I just really don't like when I go to hear a talk or something and somebody puts up a PowerPoint presentation and I say, oh no, and you see on the bottom it says slide 1 of 9,872 slides, you know, and then it's got little bitty print and they proceed to read every word on the screen, and I'm not going to do that, but so I very rarely use PowerPoint. Sometimes I'll use maps and so on, talking about battles and so on with PowerPoint, but I understand the visual aid, but I think what we'll do tonight is to talk about the history of battlefield preservation as basically a generational movement, and I think we all can associate with that. And in fact, I am convinced that that is the best way to look at the battlefield preservation movement. And in fact, what I've determined, and came out in the book, of course, is that there are basically seven generations of battlefield preservationists over the course of 150 years. Now, we've just celebrated the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. So if we take it from basically 1865 at the end of the war up through essentially 2015. We're two or three years late now, but over the course of 150 years, there have been about seven generations, and you'll see more of that as we get into it. Now, that's not counting the original preservation that took place actually during the war itself. Did you know that some of the soldiers and the armies actually preserved some of their battlefields during the war itself? There were monuments that were actually put up during the war itself. For instance, at Manassas, the battlefield of Manassas. How many have been to Manassas? There's some monuments that are no longer there. The foundation is. But a couple of the bigger, older monuments were put up right in 1865, right at the tail end of the war. There was a monument put up at Vicksburg at the surrender site where Pemberton met Grant. Right there in 1860, I believe it was put up a year later in 1864. The oldest monument that is still in its original site, on its original site, is at the battlefield of Stones River. Anybody been to Stones River down there? The Hazen Monument was put up in 1863, and it is still there. And so when these soldiers place monuments, they're marking at least a small section of the battlefield and say, hey, something happened here. Something important happened here. So that's really the beginnings of the preservation movement. You had one of these right here in Kentucky. Everybody been to Rowlett Station, where the 32nd Indiana fought? That monument is no longer there. I believe it's at the National Cemetery in Louisville, I believe is where it is. I would have to check on that. But it's not on site, but there was a monument put up there immediately after the battle. Now, you can put monuments up, of course, and as we have seen in several of these, monuments can come and go. You can take monuments down, as we see now. You know, there's a big controversy over putting up monuments and taking down monuments and where to put monuments and all that kind of stuff. So there's not necessarily permanent preservation when you place a monument. What is more permanent, and even this is not, I guess, terribly, you know, it can be undone, in terms of eventual, you know, progress and moving things and so on. And what I'm talking about are national cemeteries. During the war itself, the federal government came in and began to establish national cemeteries on battlefields. For instance, the cemetery at Chattanooga, the cemetery at Mill Springs or near Mill Springs, not necessarily on the battlefield itself, but several of these battlefields got national cemeteries. And so when you place the Civil War dead in these national cemeteries on the battlefields themselves, that is fairly permanent. You would have to come in and, you know, TVA has done a little bit of this and so on, removing cemeteries, but that is a long, laborious process. And those will be there till, you know, the second coming, I guess, when everything will be removed at that point. But this is a much more permanent process that the federal government's involved in, and a lot of these cemeteries would be on the battlefields themselves. Now, in terms of the generational movement, starting immediately after the war, the first generation, what I call the veterans generation, and that is when the veterans themselves began the process immediately after the war and reaching up until about 1890, so somewhat 30 or so years after the Civil War, the veterans, particularly Union veterans, began to mark some of their battlefields, primarily Gettysburg. And of course, Gettysburg gets all the attention. Gettysburg is way overblown in every possible way. But most of this occurred at Gettysburg, but it was private. It was one-sided, and it was not permanent. It was not total by any means of the imagination. And the reason for this probably is that it's just too soon after the war to really get a consensus on what they were fighting about. I mean, we're still fighting over that now. What was the, you ask anybody in Mississippi, what was the war over? Well, it was about tariffs. Well, what's a tariff? I don't know. you know, but they, granddaddy told them it was about tariffs. There's still arguments over what the war was over. I'm firmly convinced it was mainly over slavery. And so the racial issues that are going on, of course, during the war itself, during Reconstruction, and during your Gilded Age there, these wounds are open and raw. And for the two sides to come together and to agree to honor their soldiers on a joint battlefield, it's just not going to happen for the first 15, 20, 25 years after the war. So the veteran generation is limited. It's one-sided. It's mostly done by the Union forces, by the Union soldiers, veterans. And as a result, it is limited, most of the work being done at Gettysburg itself. But then we turn a corner in 1890. 1890 is a watershed year for the preservation movement, and this brings in the second generation, what I call the golden age of battlefield preservation. And this is when the federal government steps in and gets involved. And they're going to change things from the way it was done at Gettysburg, because it's no longer going to be partially done as it was done at Gettysburg because of lack of funding and private and all that. It's no longer going to be one-sided. They're going to include the Confederates because, as you well know, what's going on later after Reconstruction in your Gilded Age, that the two sides, whites in the North and the South, are going to come together. And they're going to find issues they can agree on. We've been arguing over this for decades, and way before the Civil War, back to the founding of the country. Let's get rid of those issues that we can't agree on, and let's find issues we can agree on. And what more can we agree on than the bravery of our great soldiers of the 1860s, North and South? Let's memorialize them. Let's honor them on our Civil War battlefields. And, of course, this is done at the expense of who? Literally the expense of taxpayers, but the expense of African Americans who are shunted to the side. When Reconstruction ends and the federal government takes the amazing stance that African Americans are separate but equal. Plessy versus Ferguson in the 1890s. Segregation, which will be the rule of the day for the next 60, 70, 80 years. So what the war was about is shunted to the side as whites of both North and South come together on issues they can agree on. And so we see this major movement of the federal government creating what I call the golden age in terms of actual physical preservation. And I kind of describe this as it's like all the stars align here and makes this the best time to preserve battlefields. For instance, you still have the veterans around that can come back to a battlefield and say, right here, this is where my unit was, this is where I fought, this is where I was wounded, this is where this happened. It's not going to be long until the veterans are no longer there, because if you were, 20, 30 years old in 1860, what's the age expectancy, life expectancy in those days? 60, 70, nothing like today. By the time you get much past the 1890s, these veterans are going to be passing on, and you're going to lose a wealth of information there. At the same time, Congress and state legislatures are heavily, made up of veterans of the war, and they're willing to appropriate the money for this. So that star aligns as well. And then you've got still pristine battlefields in the 1890s. What's coming along in the 19-teens, 1920s in just a little bit? The Second Industrial Revolution, mobility, automobiles, all that kind of stuff. What happens to cities, small towns during the Second Industrial Revolution? They mushroom, right? Most Civil War battles are fought right around towns. You name them. Gettysburg, Fredericksburg, Petersburg, Chattanooga, Atlanta, Vicksburg, Corinth. I mean, most battles are fought right around towns. And so as these cities begin to grow during this time period, they're going to engulf these battlefields. And past the 1920s, you don't have pristine battlefields anymore. So the time to preserve battlefields was in the 1890s, when all these stars align. And as a result, we get the five biggest and best battlefields out there. I may be a little bit biased. But you go to Shiloh, Vicksburg, Chickamauga, Gettysburg, Antietam. And you can go to huge battlefields and to exact spots where veterans marked and so on. You go to Stones River or Manassas or play, just fractions of those battlefields that were preserved later are actually preserved. So the time to do it was during this time period in the 1890s, stretching into the early 1900s. And that's what I call the golden age of battlefield preservations. But all things, good things come to an end. There was a break in time, a gap in there until we get to the next generation that rises up in the 1920s. This is what I call the interregnum. You know what an interregnum is? Kind of a point between two larger groups. Between the Golden Age and what will come later in the 1930s, obviously with the New Deal and all these parks that come about during that time period, it's very important what happens in the 1920s in between. This is when the U.S. Army comes in and says, all right, we're going to do a study. What do? If you're the government, you tax things and you study things, right? Well, they did a study in 1925 ranking all the Civil War battlefields and saying, all right, this is where this one ranks, this is where this one ranks, this is how much preservation we should do at this one. Did a huge study. Not much got preserved out of it, but they did a huge study, and they started the process of actually preserving. Now, some of the more famous battlefields come about during this time period as well. For instance, Fredericksburg, Spotsylvania. Y'all been to Chancellorsville in the wilderness and so on up there. Petersburg, Fort Donelson, and Stones River in our local area here. But, again, you go to Stones River. It was not preserved until the late 1920s and early 1930s. What percentage of Stones River's battlefield is preserved today? It's like 10%. Very small. Can you go find where the 32nd Indiana fought at Stones River? No. There's no tablet like it is at Shiloh, because these battlefields are preserved after the veterans are gone. After, how many veterans are still around in the 1930s? Not a lot. There may be a few, but not a lot. The battlefields are no longer pristine. There are not a lot of support in Congress and state legislatures to appropriate money for this. So you can see why the 1890s was a golden age of preservation. Still, things got done in the 1920s and continued on, of course, in the 1930s. The other big time period flanking the interregnum is the New Deal generation. This will be the fourth generation. And it is here, of course, that the federal government has lots of money to throw around. And a lot of that is going, of course, to preserve Civil War battlefields. And we get some of the more famous battlefields, federal battlefields, preserved here as well, such as Kennesaw Mountain, Manassas, Appomattox. Have y'all been to Appomattox? The other one? Richmond. The battlefields around Richmond. So the federal government is involved in this, but there's a subtle difference in what's going on in the 1930s as what had gone on in the 1920s and even back in the 1890s. A lot of this funding, yes, it may be coming from the federal government, but it is no longer directly appropriated by Congress. In the 1920s and 1890s and so on, Congress would appropriate money. There's a difference in authorizations and appropriations. You can authorize a bunch of stuff but not fund it. And so when you authorize it and appropriate it, you put specific money to it. What Congress gets into doing in starting in the 1930s, and you'll see this progress even more later on, they'll authorize parks, but they won't fund it. And they'll say, okay, we've got to get funding somewhere else. Well, during the New Deal, that's not that big a deal, because you've got the Resettlement Administration, you've got the CCC, and all these alphabet soup agencies that has money laying around to do these projects. So that's how we get a lot of these: Kennesaw Mountain, Appomattox, Richmond. And in fact, Richmond was a state park that was donated to the federal government. So there's not a lot of actual pure funding by the federal government. Even in the 1930s, it came indirectly from elsewhere, and this will grow as we move on. Now, what we see in the 1920s, 1930s, actually, because the federal government is beginning to kind of slip out of the battlefield preservation business, if you will, what we begin to see is the rise of state parks preserving battlefields. Maybe these some battlefields don't rank up to the level. You know, there's a hierarchy of important places in America, right? The most important places are going to be national parks most of the time, right? Now, if you get a little bit lower, you know, it may not be a national park, maybe a national historic landmark, national register, things like that. But below that will be state parks. If it's a state park, it's still pretty important, maybe not national in significance, but pretty important. And then you get down to lower level county parks and local parks and all that kind of stuff. My wife is a sucker for when we go on trips. She likes to go to the welcome station when we come into Kentucky or wherever and get all the brochures about everything, and she will invariably find something way out in the middle of nowhere that has a pretty picture, and we got to go see it. Nobody's ever heard of it, but it won't rest until we go see this thing. And I don't know how many times we've chased things all over the place, and finally I've gotten to where I tell her, look, if it was anything to see, it would be a national park. You know, so there's no need to go see. It's not even a state park. So there is nothing there, nothing to be seen here. And that actually works a little bit, and we've wasted a lot of time chasing stuff that really didn't pan out. But you understand the hierarchy here. We have national parks, state parks, and so on. Now, that's not to say that some things are not important and maybe should be national parks. You have, in terms of the state parks, the systems begin to arise in the 1920s, 1930s. In fact, a lot of state park systems are celebrating now their 75th anniversary. And so on. Tennessee just celebrated its, I believe it's 75th anniversary back several years earlier. So this is when these state parks arise. I'm not sure when Kentucky's state park system emerges, but it's probably right around that same time. If there is a state park that probably should be a national park, I would argue that it would be right here in Kentucky, Perryville, which was a major Civil War battle. In fact, there was a bill in Congress in the 1890s. There were tons of bills in the 1890s to create more national parks along the lines of Shiloh and Gettysburg and all that. But we didn't have the money then. How much does it cost to do it now? Obviously, you should have done it then. But it didn't go anywhere. There was a bill to preserve Perryville as a national military park. Wouldn't it be nice to go to the Perryville National Military Park today? What impact would that have on Kentucky's economy? You were talking about somebody was talking about Mammoth Cave and the impact and so on earlier. So it's unfortunate in that it was never preserved as a national park, and I think it probably warrants that very important battle. But it is a state park, and as a result, it is preserved partially in that manner. So during the New Deal era, 1933-ish to 1945, after World War II, we do see some federal parks, but the federal government begins to back away from this process, certainly funding these big national military parks, and we begin to see the states come in and take the slack here. Now, as we get into the fifth generation, from basically 1945 to 1965, we name this what occurs during that time period? The centennial. This is the centennial generation, and there is a little bit of a resurgence of interest both on the federal government level and state parks and so on. But even on the federal government level, there are only four major parks that are established in those 20 years. One of the reasons probably is because all the big ones are already established and you're starting to run out of battlefields, but there are still others. But none of these four were actually funded by the federal government. So that illustrates how the federal government is getting out of this. One is Fort Sumter. Who owns Fort Sumter prior to its transfer to the National Park Service? The War Department. The federal government already owns it, so they didn't pay for that. Harper's Ferry. What they authorized Harper's Ferry, and they said, okay, we will make this a national park only when the states of Virginia, West Virginia, and Maryland acquire the land and donate it to the federal government. That's when it will become a national park. Same thing happened with two later 1960s era parks right around the centennial, Wilson's Creek and Pea Ridge out in the Trans-Mississippi. Those were authorized, but only would become actual parks when the states of Arkansas and Missouri acquired the land and donated it to the federal government. So you can see the federal government backing out of spending big money on battlefield preservation. So it falls to the states. And as a result, we began to see much more emphasis on the state level in terms of preserving these battlefields and beefing up their state park systems and so on. But as we all know, do many states have a bunch of money laying around? Does Kentucky have a bunch of money laying around wondering what to do with it today? Obviously not. Not many states do. So, what's the first thing that gets cut when a state really starts going downhill? They start cutting their historic, I remember it wasn't long ago, a decade ago or so, that Ohio began cutting staff and all that at the Ohio Historical Society. And that's one of the first things cut. And shutting down state parks, those are some of the first things that are cut when a state really gets into financial trouble, which a lot of states were at that time. So we begin to see the states doing a lot more. They couldn't do a whole lot, but they could pick up a little bit of where the federal government is leaving off. Now, none of these state parks, obviously, are going to rank up there with national parks in terms of infrastructure and size and all that. I mean, you go to Perryville, and it's when it was established, it was only a fraction of the battlefield. We've added to it since then, Civil War Trust and so on. But the states didn't go in totality here. They just preserved a little bit, maybe put up a monument and so on. So they couldn't do just a whole lot. Now, once we get past the centennial and kind of a resurgence of interest, interest really just kind of takes a nosedive in terms of battlefield preservation. As we enter the sixth generation, I told you all this generational movement here. As we enter the sixth generation, I call this the Dark Ages, because this is kind of the low point of battlefield preservation from basically 1965 to 1990, living through the economic turmoil, just all kinds of turmoil, 1968 and all that, you know. But this is a time of Jimmy Carter and inflation and high gas prices and all that. Then you get the conservatism of the 1980s. What did Ronald Reagan say when he took office? Government is not the solution to the problem. Government is the problem. And he puts everybody on notice, I'm going to cut federal spending. Now, he doesn't cut it as much as he says he is. He cuts taxes, but doesn't cut the federal spending. But there was even an effort, I believe, who's the Interior Secretary, James Watt, to put a moratorium on new federal government lands and purchases and expansion and all that. So there is a definite conservatism. And so all this put together, we get in basically a time of just the Dark Ages. Not much is going on. In fact, there is a grand total of one national park established during this whole generation here, from 1965 to 1990. Anybody know what it is? It was Andersonville, and it wasn't even a battlefield. It was a prison camp, and it was owned by the War Department or the Defense Department at that point. So the government's not spending money on that, and it was just transferred over to become the Andersonville National Historic Site. It was a prison camp. There are a lot of state parks, again, coming to fruition during this time period, but even there, you know, hard up on money and so on. So it's very difficult to get much of anything done during this time period that costs any money. Now, what the federal government can do is what? Well, another Reagan quote. What does Reagan say? If it exists, tax it. If it moves, tax it. And if it hangs around so long, tax it and all that. Federal government's good at doing what? Taxing and regulating, right? There are theoretical preservation initiatives started during this time period. Instead of actual preservation, the federal government's going to tell you how to preserve. And what I'm talking about here, there are numerous pieces of legislation that emerge during this time period that will tell you basically how we're going to do this. The National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. Anybody familiar with that? That tells you how you're going to preserve, what you have to do. The most important, Section 106. You've heard of Section 106. Every state has to have a state historic preservation officer and all that kind of stuff. It mandates how we're going to preserve in terms of federal dollars and lands and all that kind of stuff. ARPA. You ever heard of ARPA? All these have, of course, acronyms. Archaeological Resources Protection Act. You ever heard of that? What happens if you go metal detecting on the Shiloh battlefield? You'll get in trouble. They'll arrest you and put you in jail, and they'll take your firstborn, your house, and your wife, and everything else. That is, a lot of metal detector folks and relic hunters and so on are charged under ARPA, the Archaeological Resources Protection Act. Comes around in the 1970s. NEPA. Anybody ever heard of NEPA? The National Environmental Protection Act. You can't do anything federal government-wise without getting all these permits and so on to make sure that you don't mess with the little microorganisms that exist that you can't even see. But we can't disturb their habitat, of course. And all that is theorized under the National Environmental Protection Act. National Federal Highways Administration, all of these different agencies and pieces of legislation come about to regulate how we preserve. And instead of actually doing actual preservation, they tell us how you can and can't preserve. So that adds even more, I think, into the Dark Ages. Now, we get to the final generation, of course, Generation 7. and think back into your world history here, Western Civ, what always happens in class after the Dark Ages? What comes along? The Renaissance. Generation 7 is a renaissance in every sense of the word. From about 1990 to the present, we have had an absolute boom, a resurgence of battlefield preservation that followed the Dark Ages, but it comes back and is probably stronger today than it's ever been. It started in a lot of different ways. The 125th anniversary of the Civil War was late 80s, early 1990s. A lot of reenactors. And so you're a reenactor. Did you go to any of the reenactments in late 80s and early 90s?
In the 90s, not in the
80s. One of the most famous, I forget what year it was, but they called it Mudlow. It was a reenactment of Shiloh.
I was there.
Did you go to Mudlow?
Yeah.
It rained so hard that, you know, it was just a debacle. Exactly, yeah. So there's a resurgence in reenacting and interest in the battlefields and all that. This is right about the same time that we began to get these movies. The movie Glory came out in, what, 1989, 88 or so. Gettysburg came out with Martin Sheen and Jeff Barringer and who's the guy that Dumb and Dumber, Jeff Daniels. How he plays Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain and then plays Dumb and Dumber. He must be a good actor. I don't know. But Gettysburg, followed by, of course, Gods and Generals. Anybody like Gods and Generals? I always say we didn't really know how good Gettysburg was till Gods and Generals came out. And then we figured out how good Gettysburg was. This is also, of course, the time period, probably most famously, that what appears? Ken Burns, The Civil War on PBS. How many of you watched on every night for 10 or 11 nights there in what, 1990, the fall of 1990, I believe? Ken Burns series, and just an amazing amount. And of course, historians pick it apart, and there's a book that came out from Oxford University Press. You know, well, he should have done this, and he should have done that. I always love it when historians say, you should have done all this, and the book that you wrote, they want you to write the book that they would have written. You write the book if you want that. So they picked Ken Burns' film apart. You know, it wasn't enough about slavery. Wasn't enough about this. Wasn't enough about that. And so. But I think it's a pretty good piece of work that really revolutionized people and instilled in people, hey, the Civil War is important. And by extension, of course, the preservation part of this. Now, this is the time period that we get, of course, the famous Civil War Sites Advisory Commission. The federal government steps back up to the plate and says, okay, maybe we should get back involved in this. And there's a study done by the big historians, Bill Cooper at LSU and James McPherson and some of those, Ed Bars, that studied each of these battlefields and figured out which ones were the most important and which ones really need the preservation. They made all these recommendations. They came up with, like, I think it's 482 really important battles in the Civil War that we should think about preserving, and they ranked them in tiers and all that kind of stuff and told Congress, this is what you need to do, this is how we need to do it and all that. And Congress, of course, did what?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. And so the interest kind of took another nosedive, if you will, during the 1990s. We get into other issues in the 1990s. For instance, the Republican takeover in 1994, Newt Gingrich in contract with America and all that, brings back in conservatism and, you know, not spending as much government money and so on. So that kind of puts a damper on it just a little bit. Some of the scandals of the 1990s takes, you know, attention away from everything and puts it on, you know, Monica Lewinsky and all that kind of stuff. So we get a little bit of a nosedive in interest there. But fortunately, we have a movement brewing during that time period that is really going to take off and really is going to sustain the process of preservation even till today. I believe it was 1987 that a group of historians met in a restaurant in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and created what? He's got his original hat back there, the Association of Preservation of Civil War Sites, the APCWS, yeah. In fact, one of the movers and shakers said they talked about different names, and he said it's not necessarily the best name, but everybody was tired at that point, so they just went with anything. So very quickly, they realized this is not the best name in the world, and they merged with another preservation organization that had emerged called the Civil War Trust. And those two groups, after some heated controversy back and forth and so on, they managed to merge together right around 1999-2000 into the Civil War Preservation Trust, which now has been shortened to the Civil War Trust. Any of y'all members of the Civil War Trust? I know you are. And that it is the movement today. There are 50, 60,000 members, I believe, that really, and a lot of them are just regular members that pay our $30 bucks a year or whatever. But then there are some sure enough members that, you know, pay $50,000 a year and so on, color bearers and all of that. And so the movement here, they have, to date, I think it's up to like 48,000 acres that has been saved in those 30 years. And what this is, of course, it's non-government, grassroots work by the people and passionate people that's getting things done. Why? Because the government wouldn't do it. The government's been backing away from this since the 1920s. The states can't do it. So it's a grassroots movement from the bottom up that is doing absolutely amazing work. And I think that's the future of battlefield preservation today. So can you see how this is a renaissance, how interest is back up following the dead years of the Dark Ages? That gets us, of course, to 2015. What will happen in the future, I don't know. There are some lessons, I think, however, we can learn from the past 150 years. And I'll end talking about these lessons, and then we can take some questions. We got time for questions if you want to. But there are some patterns. I think that's a pretty good sample size over the course of 150 years. That's 100% sample size, you know. So we can learn some lessons. One is that the federal government's not going to do it. They're not going to do their job. This is such a big mammoth job that it needs a big mammoth amount of money and entity to be able to do it. But the federal government has said, no, we're not going to do it. We're going to govern the ones we have, but we're not going to, you know, get into doing much of this anymore. There have been calls for a national battlefield preservation policy in the 1890s, in the 1920s, in the 1930s, in the 1960s, in the 1990s, and every time Congress says, oh, we know, we're not fooling with that. So I don't think the federal government's ever going to get involved. And as a result, the grassroots part of this is what is so special and what is so important about this. So that obviously is the future of this. Another pattern that we see is the generational movement, of course. And we've been talking about that. What is important there, I think, however, and we can look at patterns in terms of each generation. What I found really interesting is that between each of these generations, from the veterans early on doing Gettysburg and so on, one-sided and limited and all that, between that and the federal government beginning the sponsorship in 1890, it's completely two different groups, basically. And so there's a significant break between what was done prior to 1890 and what was done in 1890 on. Now, there's another significant break after these 1890 generation folks die off and so on in the 19-teens and early 1920s, and the Army takes over. Completely new set of folks there. Now, that lasts until 1933, and had the Army continued on, I think they would have produced some pretty good results with their study that they had done in 1925 and so on. But 1933, we didn't actually mention it, but 1933 is another break year. Why? What happens to the battlefield parks in 1933? The federal government, the President Franklin Roosevelt, transfers them from the War Department. Originally, they were in the War Department for officers to go study. That was one of the reasons they were established, for military officers to study historic battles. But they're transferred in 1933 to the National Park Service. And the National Park Service says, we don't want you old Army officers. You know, we got our own ways of educating and interpreting and all that. So there's another clear break between the 1920s and the 1930s. Now, when the 1930s New Deal generation is over, everything goes to the war, of course, in the 1940s. What did Roosevelt say? Dr. New Deal has been replaced by Dr. Win the War. So there's another break there between that generation and the centennial generation. Then there's a break, obviously, in the Dark Ages. And so the folks that are involved in the Renaissance had not necessarily been involved in the last major movement of the Centennial, unless you're Ed Barsh, and he was wounded during the war, I think. You know, he's been around a long time. So each generation, there was a break, a clear, distinct break, and each time you had to reinvent the wheel. Each time, this generation had to pick up and start basically from scratch. And how much spinning of the wheels did it take to do that? You know, now, what's important here, of course, is that the Civil War Trust is at another watershed moment, I think, or it will be in a couple more years. Who's the head of the Civil War Trust? Jim Lighthizer?
Yes.
A lot of this is riding on the back of Jim Lighthizer. He's a very charismatic man. He's very, very good at what he does. Jim Lighthizer is not going to be around forever. What happens when he's gone? Are they grooming? Are they thinking about, you know, transition and so on? If the Civil War Trust is able to transition into new leadership and a new generation, this will be the first time in the Battlefield Preservation Movement history that it transcends one generation to another. And I actually say in the book, if they don't, and I don't mean this disparagingly toward the Civil War Trust, but if they don't, they will be just yet another one of these generational movements that we saw, like the Army and the New Deal and the Golden Age veterans and all that. As good a job as they have done, that movement will falter and somebody else will have to reinvent the wheel and start over later, brand new from scratch. So if they can bridge the transition here, the Civil War Trust, you know, the sky's the limit. Where can they go? And I have every confidence. They're already talking about, you know, leadership transition and so on. There are also kind of another lesson. We're starting to see new manners and means of preservation. The question, when I first started this, I thought, well, now I got to define preservation. What does it mean to preserve a battlefield? Is it just when you acquire the land? Or is it when you start putting up interpretation? Or is it when you start visitors coming there, open it to the public? Exactly what is preservation? Well, it could be all of that, obviously. I chose to do with just the initial preserving from basically private to a preservation ownership. I didn't get into all the, you know, what's happened with every rail fence between here and Gettysburg and all that, because that's administrative, that's maintenance. I'm not interested necessarily in that. But once it is actually moved from private hands that could make it to where it's in danger of being spoiled, to the point that it is no longer in danger of being spoiled, that to me is preservation. And you know, over time we start to run out of big battlefield land. But what we're starting to see now is actually a new movement. We've seen this at Franklin and elsewhere, called rehab, taking places that had a hotel on it or a golf course on it, and rehabbing that and rehabilitating that back into pristine battlefield land. Now, is it pristine anymore? No. It's still the ground where it happened, but it's not, you know, pristine. But we don't have any better option at those places. That's the best we've got. So we're starting to see even new methods appear here. So the generational movement, very important in terms of understanding the battlefield preservation. And I hope you have learned a little bit. And I hope next time you step foot on a preserved Civil War battlefield, you think about, somebody didn't just snap their fingers in Washington and this appeared. It took a lot of effort, a lot of planning, a lot of it by the veterans themselves. So say thank you to the people who came before us and preserved those battlefields. And even better than that, get involved with battlefield preservation today. Join the Civil War Trust and see what, you know, you can preserve for future generations. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer those if we've got a minute or two. I have no idea what time it is, actually. Yes, sir.
It's not really a question. It's an invitation to you and anyone within earshot, even that guy. It's 4th of July at Vicksburg. My organization called Lincoln's Generals is going to be doing a reenactment of the surrender. We've got Grant. We've got Pemberton. We're going to have a PGT Beauregard, whether or not he was appropriate or anything, but Since most of us are Union generals, we appreciate any grain we can get.
Right.
But it's going to be a reenactment of the surrender on the 4th of July at Vicksburg, probably at the monument you mentioned.
Wow, interesting.
So if you're, from Martin, far drive,
Of course, Vicksburg surrendered on July the 4th. The original negotiations for capitulation started on July the 3rd.
Yeah.
And actually, the monument, you mentioned the monument, is a second-generation monument now out there between the lines. It's a cannon shaft that was put up later on. The original monument is actually inside the visitor center at Vicksburg because it was getting damaged and all that. So they put it on display inside the visitor center and erected a cannon shaft, decades, probably not 100 years ago, but a long time ago. To mark the actual site. What's interesting on the original shaft is got the date wrong, actually. It says, at this spot, Generals Grant and Pemberton met on July the 4th, 1863, to discuss terms of capitulation of Vicksburg and all that. Well, they didn't meet on July the 4th. They surrendered on July 4th. They met on July the 3rd, the day before, and it took them, 12 hours or so to negotiate and sending messages back and forth and so on. So even they got a little bit of their history wrong. So that's interesting. The Park Service is working with you on this and all that. That's great.
Loved by the
reenactment of the surrender of Vicksburg.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, we did the 150th. But I guess it wasn't advertised very well because there weren't a lot of people. But they're trying to build the crowd. And I encourage anybody to come because it's a great park.
Yes, it is. Great park.
And it's fun.
You going to eat rats, Michael?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to eat rats?
I'm going to eat rats. No. I'm sorry. Union General.
They were a little better supplied.
Train, John Rawlins, General Grant's
aide. Oh, Grant's aide. Yeah. He's conscious. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
So as I'm listening to you talking about these seven moments of sort of resurgences of interest in Civil War preservation, I'm also struck by these are also moments of great racial strife in the United States. There's a direct correlation.
Exactly.
Going through. So how do people within the trust deal with this in moments of like Black Lives Matter, with these civil rights movements? How do they sensitively deal with the fact that there is this whole legacy of slavery tied up with these battlefields? Do they address that, or is that just something they push to the side?
Right. The racial issue is very important, as we talked about it at the beginning, of course, with the movement towards segregation and allowing whites of North and South to come back together. And in fact, as you go on, and I didn't really get into it in terms of the generational movements, but in the 1920s, for instance, when we first start to see, most of the time the civil rights movement, we say, started in the 1950s, Brown versus Board of Education in the 1960s. It goes back to desegregating the military in the 40s, into squabbling over segregated CCC camps and all that in the 30s, even somewhat back in the into the 20s, and somewhat back into progressivism and so on, and so as we start to see the embryonic development of the civil rights movement, they didn't know it was the civil rights movement then, but we can look back and see. That is exactly the same time you start to see the embryonic reaction by Southerners, in the 1890s and early 1900s, 1910s, you didn't need a KKK. You didn't need to terrorize blacks to keep them from voting and so on like that. But once you start to see a little bit of movement, you start to see a little bit of resurgence of white supremacy and all that kind of stuff. And, for instance, Richmond and Manassas, and there's a little bit of animosity there, in Virginia about why are we giving them our state park? It'll just be Yankee historians writing history and they won't get it right. And this is a Confederate park. Manassas was originally a private park called, I believe it was the Confederate National Park or something like that. And later it was given to the National Park Service and so on. So you start to see that a little bit. And certainly when you get into the 1960s with the civil rights movement and so on, what I found, and I deal with in the book, is that battlefield preservation lags behind maybe a generation or so. It's not really into the 1980s and 1990s that we start to see even the National Park Service start to memorialize and mark places where, say, United States colored troops were active and so on. So, in the 1960s, you got the civil rights movement, but really that's only becoming really a memorialized feature now. It's 50 years. It's almost synonymous with Civil War. You know, Civil War took place in the 1860s, and it's only in the 1890s and early 1900s that we start to see battlefields appear and so on. The Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s, it's only 1990s, early 2000s that we start to see, for instance, Mississippi marking various civil rights places and so on. So it's a very interesting correlation there. The way the Civil War Trust handles it today, they are, I think, they don't want to do anything controversial. In fact, there was a survey that just went out to all the members, you know, what do you think about removing monuments? What do you think about this and all that? And I think the basic idea that most of the membership said was, let's don't get into the political issues, let's just save battlefield. Let's save as much battlefield land as we possibly can. So they're trying to stay distinct from, you know, they don't want to go on the side of the South was right and the South's going to rise again, but they don't want to go to the other side, the pendulum too far the other side, you know, you know, it was all about slavery and had nothing else to do with states' rights and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, the truth lies oftentimes in the middle, most of the time as well. So the trust, I think, is trying to stay apolitical, and you've got liberals and you've got conservatives, you've got Democrats and Republicans as part of the trust, and they're trying to probably walk a fine line to keep the money rolling in and to keep preserving. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes, sir.
I was mentioned that, if I understand it correctly, Ken Burns is going to be over in Knoxville the middle of April to the latter part of April. I think it's $55 ticket admission, and I believe he's going to address the Civil War as his topic.
Oh, really? Ken Burns in Knoxville dealing with the Civil War. It'd be interesting to hear his take on that. It'd be interesting. All right. Are we...
Any other questions?
We through with,
are we good?
Out of time?
Well,
we've got one question. Final question.
The organization that's now in place, is it representative of all genders and all races, or is it heavily white?
The Civil War Trust?
Yeah.
Well, to be perfectly honest, it is probably made up more so of old, rich white men than anything, because they're, you know, have a lot of money and interested in the history and so on. But there are a lot of younger folks involved, females involved. There's not a lot of African-American involvement, but that gets into the whole thing, you know, African-American interest in Civil War things and Civil War parks. African-American visitation at Civil War parks is extremely low. And... you know, you extrapolate it out. This is where African Americans won, you know, freedom and citizenship, and you would think would be more interested. But African American involvement in visiting Civil War sites and so on in the Civil War Trust is almost non-existent, actually. But there are a lot of younger folks and stretching across the gender gap there.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed being here.